Sorry, I'm not sure how to rise to my feet and interject when I'm on the screen.
I don't think this has the little hand you can put up and wave. Anyway, yes, Ms. Carruthers.
I did try a natural wave, but I wasn't sure if I'd get your attention. Just a question of process, sir, before we start with the next witness. I just wanted to check this court's expectations around questions arising after the court's questions.
Well, as a matter of natural justice, I have always, in experience at the bar and then on the bench, I have always felt it's important, given that we ask our questions after cross-examination and re-examination, that there is a reasonable opportunity, if something unexpected has come up, that the party has an opportunity to raise it. There have been a few occasions where, and no one present here, but there have been a few occasions where counsel have seized the opportunity to attempt to open up a new line of questioning, and we stop that. I mean, is there a particular thing you're concerned about with questions, with matters arising?
No, sir. It was more just checking whether all counsel had the opportunity or it was just the party calling the witness.
Oh, no. No, it would be... But it would be any party with an interest in the matters that the court was asking questions about, but it would very much be limited to clarifying or checking something rather than continuing the process of cross-examination or re-examination.
Yes, thank
Does
you,
that
sir.
Assist?
It does, thank you very much.
So, as has been happening so far, and as I would anticipate, it would be something that would be relatively rare. But I won't stop it if it's appropriate. Anyway, thank you, Ms. Carruthers. Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, sir. I now call the Council's third witness, Mr. Boxock, who is an armed systems expert.
Thank you.
His evidence can be found at Volume 301, tabs 6 and 7.
Thank you.
Would you like to turn the back of your phone?
Afternoon, Mr. Broxop. Is your full name Adrian Charles Broxop?
It is.
Did you prepare evidence in chief dated 26 May 2023 and rebuttal evidence dated 25 August 2023? Do you have the qualifications and experience set out in paragraphs 2 to 6 of your evidence in chief?
Yeah.
Do you have any corrections to your evidence?
Right.
Did you attend Farm Systems Expert Caucusing on 6th to 8th of September and sign the joint witness statement?
I did.
And do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge?
Yes, it is.
Thank you. Please answer any questions.
Do you mind if I have questions for this witness?
No, Your Honour.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Mr. Ryan and Ms. Boulow on the line for the River Authority.
Yes, sir, but no questions. Thank you.
Thank you. you, Mr. Pennell. I might come in the usual way. I might come back to you a little later, and we'll see what other counsel have to ask this witness. Is that all right?
Yes, for that, sir.
You're all right with that, Mr. Pennell?
Yes, I am.
Very good.
Are you hearing me now?
Yes, I can hear you now. Thank you very much.
Yes, that order suits me. Thank you.
Very good. All right.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. Broxall. I've got a few questions for you. I will start with the nitrogen risk scorecard. You do cover this in your evidence in chief, and you explain that you did review it in the context of, I think, 4 farms. And can I just confirm your position is that the risk scorecard is the only practical option for a tool to be used as a drafting gate for dairy within Plan Change 1?
So I modelled only 4 farms, and that was more of a time restriction. That was to give us an idea of working with the scorecard myself to see that it was fit for purpose. The output of that, working with some random farms, so not farms that have been modelled before, gave results that were consistent with, as we could see, the data suggesting an increase in risk on farm. It gave an increase in risk on the model. But because it was only 4 farms, that was very difficult to say. It was a small data set. So in terms of would it work and did it ask all the right questions in the right places, I would say yes. In terms of is it appropriate for the what we're talking about here in terms. I previously used Overseer extensively as a tool, but obviously I worked on the assumption that in the guidance I've been given that Overseer was not available. So in terms of looking at other appropriate mechanisms out there, it was the only thing that was I could feasibly see was available at the common point and not in a pilot phase or a development phase, and by those I mentioned the MFE card that's been scorecard that's been developed.
Thank you. We'll now move on to some questions around intensification and reporting requirements. Do you agree that as intensification of farming practices increases, so does potential risk?
Agree if all things are being equal in terms of if that was the same farm on the same soil types and that farmer did not put any further mitigations in to counteract that intensification, you would likely expect that there would be an increased risk.
Yes, and in your evidence as well, you also discussed the need for rigour in data collection and reporting processes?
Yes, definitely. Again, experience from Overseer modelling, what you would expect sometimes from sending a form to a farmer compared to what you would get when you have the ability to sit with them at the kitchen table, and ask those questions can sometimes be different. So whatever we do here, there needs to be some really good processes built in there for rigour, but more so cognizant of the fact that it's a numbers game in terms of we've got a lot of scorecard processing to do, so often that cannot be done personally one-on-one. So as long as we've got a process to counteract that, and that's where the rigor comes in.
Certainly, so from that perspective, anything that could be done to assist the council and the other people involved in that certification type process would assist.
Yeah.
So would you agree that providing annual data in terms of farm intensity would be useful and would help the council in its obligations in terms of the implementation of PC1?
Yes, definitely. Being able to have that comparison and looking at trend data, like anything, when we talk about Overseer or soil tests, often it's the trend that gives us the indication of the direction of where we're going, not necessarily the individual values, because we know we're in a farm system that is counteracting weather and climate a lot of the time. So I think that'd be really important that that was available to assist in the process.
And that's irrespective of the type of farming operation?
Yes.
On dry stock, moving on to dry stock, you note in your evidence in chief at paragraph 61 that most dry stock farmers have the opportunity to be permitted activities.
Yes.
301.016(3).
Yep.
Thank you. And so, given that, would you agree that robust and clear conditions are needed in schedules C, D1, D2, as far, or C and D1, as far as the minimum farming standards and those farm environment plans for otherwise permitted activities?
Yes.
So we'll go to some of those now. And so we'll first discuss stock exclusion. So you agree that stock exclusion is an important activity to mitigate contaminant loss?
Yeah, so anything that causes that initial, which is the direct contamination, so there's no pathways or anything in between, you know, an animal in the water, it's got to be something as we need to look at. And it's high priority.
And the benefits of stock exclusion, that would be for all four contaminants?
Yeah, to varying extents according to the situation that stock exclusion is taking place. So the benefit will be, you know, maybe less for certain things on flat contour versus hilly contour, dairy versus dry stock versus cropping.
And as you've mentioned dairy and dry stock, it would be applicable to both of those activities, though.
Yeah.
In terms of the slope at which stock exclusion may be required or required with some greater flexibility, you'd agree that changing the slope from the threshold from 15 degrees to 10 degrees as proposed by the council reduces the extent of waterways from which stock will be excluded?
Potentially, because those above 10, the farmer will still need to ascertain if they can meet the intensity rules as to they may need to exclude stock or find an alternative method. But in terms of by default, the waterways that would all need to be fenced under no, there's no choice because it's part of the rule, there would be less.
And are you aware that the, according to Mr. Kabilko's evidence, the primary reason for reducing the slope threshold from 15 degrees to 10 degrees was the availability of mapping of the 10 degree slopes?
Yep.
Are you aware of any particular practical barriers to excluding stock that occur when slopes are between 10 and 15 degrees?
Practical barriers in terms to just
on the farm. From your experience with farm systems, that the difference between being able to, in practice, create fencing when a paddock is at 10 degrees versus 14 degrees.
Right. Okay. Yep. So, no. As you go and get more steep, the slope gets more steep, the ability to fence, there's a lot more decisions that need to be taken place in terms of location of fence lines, and safety of building those fence lines, and looking at how and what setbacks need to be for that, so it does get more difficult as you get steeper.
plus in that range of between 10 and 15 degrees, are those significant factors?
It's very site specific as to what that would be.
Want to move on to the potential for tailored solutions or a more context specific response in terms of stock exclusion. So in your evidence you do make reference to the various rules that have a specific tailored solution that is available through a farm environment plan under a consenting process for dry stock. You also in your evidence acknowledge things like placement of water troughs, planting trees, shade, those can be some of the factors that, that would be relevant as far as that tailored solution.
Yeah.
In those contexts, if the paddock already had a trough provided and or shade, is there then the potential that there wouldn't actually be any change required as far as what the farmer might need to do on site in order to comply with those requirements under the plan?
So I'm working on the assumption that for a farmer to be able to use those tailored solutions, they're completing an FEPD2, which means it's done in conjunction with a certified consultant. So I would expect that there would be a discussion between the farmer and a site visit, between the farmer and the consultant to say, well, are the mitigations that are in there already, are they appropriate? Do we believe that they are meeting the objectives of minimising stock access?
And on that, that's in the context of a consenting process?
Yeah.
And do you think that's an important factor, that it's in the context of a consenting process?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Because there is also the ability for a tailored solution to arise in the context of a permitted activity as well, isn't there?
So I would expect there would still need to be an assessment. I would like to think there'd be an assessment that the actions, it's not a default that as long as you've got a truck in there and there's some trees in there that you're meeting the obligations. There needs to be an assessment and an agreement, and that's where we probably need more work, and the joint witness statement looked, there was discussion about that there is parameters or indications for number of water troughs per animal, number of trees, shade trees per metre square that are required to be seen as good practice.
Yes, because I'd like to take you to those provisions now. So do you have the council's version of provisions that were attached to Mr. Conway's legal submissions?
I've got the rebuttal version. So the rules themselves, the decisions version.
So this is the version that Mr. Conway produced yesterday. It won't be in the common bundle.
Post-conference version. Oh, this is it here.
Fantastic. So I'll just take you firstly to page 27. And so this is the permitted activity rule for low intensity farming.
Yes.
So there's 2 points. I'll take you to, firstly, right near the top of the page, 3A Roman 1 has got the threshold for dry stock farming falling within this rule.
Yes.
And so that is a stocking unit of 17 stock units per hectare, and then a cattle winter stocking rate equal to or less than 13 documents per hectare. And that applies on an overall farm basis, doesn't it?
Yes.
And then halfway down the page, it then lists the conditions that must be complied with. And would just take you to number two, which is the requirement that the minimum farming standards in Schedule C are met.
Yes.
And so if we can now skip forward to page 40, which is Schedule C and those minimum farming standards.
Yes.
And so standard one is the stock exclusion standard, and that is where it outlines a requirement for fencing for land with a slope of up to 10 degrees, and then in 1B, for land over 10 degrees in certain circumstances, which are covered in 1 and 2. And so I'd like to take you to Roman 2 there. So that talks about grazing, where the number of stock units exceeds 18 per grazed hectare. Now, that 18 per hectare, that's in the context of the particular paddock, though, isn't it, rather than on that overall farm basis?
Yes.
And so, if there were a dry stock farmer rotationally grazing, there could be a situation where paddocks adjoining a water body or a stream exceed 18 units, despite the overall farm as a whole being below that permitted 17 stock units.
Yes.
And it could be quite significantly above that 18 stock units.
Oh, you're right.
And so in that context, there is the requirement for, well, there is a requirement for stock exclusion unless a farm environment plan that's been certified confirms alternative measures. And so in terms of those three bullet points there that outline the what the farm plan certifier is looking at, you mentioned the conferencing and about having some particular standards that would guide a certifier as to what was appropriate. There's no such standards here, are there?
No, not at the moment. Recommendation or output of the conferencing was, you know, they would like to, we would all like to see that there would be standards to help the certifier to work out what was appropriate.
And from a regulatory perspective for the council, given that this is going through a process that potentially doesn't involve the council at all, and that this is that can operate in for permitted activities, it would be important to have certainty over what is sought to be achieved. Would you agree?
Yeah, there would need to be certainty. Yeah.
Just wish to take you to paragraph 117 of your evidence in chief. There's one final question. So here you've referred to Schedules D1 and D2, and then in the second sentence you've set out the various requirements that you seem to consider to be the critical aspects of the Schedules D1 and D2. There's no reference to certification within that. Was that intentional, or is that an oversight, or is it intended that it was covered in what is already outlined in your second sentence there?
second sentence of paragraph 117?
Correct. Where it starts, in my view. So that it's 301.0176, so it's volume 301, tab 6.
My version doesn't have a second sentence.
Mine doesn't.
Evidence in chief. So it starts on the halfway along the first line of paragraph 117.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I apologise. Yeah, I missed that.
So, in my view, describe.
Correct. Yes, that sentence.
Yep, I've got that now. Can you repeat the question again? Sorry.
Certainly. You don't specifically refer to certification there, but do you consider that to be an important requirement of those schedules?
For D2? Definitely, because it's looking at the values and principles, whereas D1 is more structured. So as long as the farmer can show that they're meeting those requirements, and that was always the intention, that if a farm environment plan could be self-created, but there needed to be that structure to help the farmer, and if he felt he could not do that, or he could not meet the requirements, and then you move to that next level, which would be the D2.
Okay, thank you for that. And sorry, one final question that I missed before. In the context of the tailored solutions or the alternatives to stock exclusion, do you see these as being available irrespective of the sensitivity of the water body?
That's where I'd see the requirement for an assessment with a certified person to work through that. When you think of the edge of a water body, the risk due to stock movements or bank stabilisation will be different in every situation. So I think that needs to be taken into account in terms of what are the risks in that individual situation to say, well, actually, alternative measures are not appropriate. We do actually need to fence this.
But again, those three bullets that we went to before don't provide that sort of guidance or clarity necessarily, do they?
No, not at this stage.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Minahan. And Courtney Lockyer, it's on the questions for this witness.
Does Ms. Brothers have any questions? I was hoping she might, but otherwise.
I'm here to go otherwise.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry, I do, but I thought it was Mr. Matheson next, if he's still there.
Yes, all right. Thank you. I'm getting mixed up in my numbers. And Mr. Matheson, thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Right. Thank you. Quite a bit to get through, but I shall do our best. Firstly, just confirm, you've read the evidence from the farming witnesses?
I have read them, but in fact, we'll not be able to recall
everything
at the moment, but I have read them.
Yeah, okay, that's good, just checking. Just starting with, and I want to start at a high level, and just to help you sort of where I'm going, I want to start at a high level. And at a high level, stock exclusion is very easy to say, but it has quite a number of practical implications on the farm, doesn't it?
Yes.
So, and they include things like if you fence off an area, you need to provide water to the stock.
Yes.
And you need to provide water troughs, you need to provide pipes, pumps, header tanks, you need to get power to the pumps.
Yes.
And on hill country farms, the cost of pumping can be significantly expensive. If you're pumping water up 100 or 200 metres. If you put in new fencing, you need to put in new culverts for stock crossings.
Potentially.
You need to put in new gates.
Yes.
You might need to adjust the existing paddock layouts.
Yes.
If you have small areas fenced off, you might need to undertake weed control in those areas.
Potentially, yeah.
That all sounds very expensive.
I think that's very farm specific as to what they've already done in terms of how far on that journey they are to already having reticulated water, to having the fences where they need to be, etc.
And you're asked, I think, by my friend Mr. Manhana, you know, about the cost between a 10-degree and a 15-degree requirement to fence. The difference between my clients and the dairy interests, and the dairy interests are seeking fencing effectively to occur as a matter of course up to 15 degrees. My clients are seeking to accepting fencing up to 10 degrees. Is there much dairying that occurs on land between 10 and 15 degrees?
There will be dairying, probably a relatively small proportion, but if you go into the Y Park catchment, it would be fairly significant.
So now if I could just ask you to go to members of the court, tab 1 of volume 401. If you look behind you, so this is the evidence of Mr. Cameron. Oh, sorry, 304. It will help, sorry. 304 tab 1.
Part 1.
Yep. And then if you go to, tab 1, and then if you turn to page 304.0019. So that's in, if I'm recalling this correctly, that's near the Whangapai catchment, and that's Mr. Cameron's farm. The red paddocks are conventional fencing, and the yellow paddocks are fenced with a wire. So that's the existing fencing layout now.
Yep.
And then if one goes to 304.0055, so Mr. Cameron's well advanced with his water reticulation system. Looks like he put Wodiki to shame. Love you, by the way, Commissioner.
No, I don't work for him anymore.
So that's the existing water reticulation layout on the existing paddock structure at Mr. Cameron's farm. To give you an idea about what's required when one carves up land with fencing, and you need to put a water trough. So in terms of both those last diagrams we looked at, in terms of just putting in extra fencing, whether it be for a double garage size wetland or smaller, or additional streams, or any other fencing requirements, that could require changes to both the water reticulation system, even for ones that had one, and the existing paddock layer, correct?
Yeah, correct.
Um, now, if I can ask you to look at Mr. Leary's evidence, and that is 304-0966. Sorry, tab 13, sorry. Yeah. Tab 13, and it's 304-0966. Sorry, actually, if we start, can we start, sir, on 304-0966? Yeah, 63. 304-0963. Just pulled it up. So that will have, so it's appended, an extra RV15 MFE low slope net for the tea tree. Got that there? Yeah. So the stock exclusion regulations incorporate by reference a GIS layer which is held on the MFE website, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's the national GIS layer that allows anybody to zoom in on any part of their farm, and they'll get the printout that's shown on this diagram layer. And that shows, so that lets every farmer or every landowner in New Zealand go on to that national database, and they get shown land which is from 0 to 5 degrees, which is in purple, 5 to 10 degrees, which is in grey effectively, and then above 10 degrees, which is no colour. That's correct? The stock exclusion regulations only require fencing in the purple areas, don't they? The PC1 proposal requires fencing in the grey areas, doesn't it, as the council's proposal?
Yes.
And the proposal by Fonterra and DairyNZ and some other parties, i.e. fencing up to 15 degrees, would require additional fencing. How much we don't know, but it will require potentially significant additional fencing beyond that already shown. So from a practical usability perspective, if a farmer knew they needed to fence streams, and we'll come back to what the streams mean, within the grey areas, they can go to their farm, have a look at it, and see immediately what is or is not required to be fenced. That's relatively easy to identify, isn't it?
Yes.
As opposed to going out onto every single fence line and trying to work out whether it's 15 degrees or not, or potential fence line.
Yeah, yeah, or mapping as errors or accuracy, but it's going to get people in the right ballpark, in the right paddock, and something that is a really good starting point.
Yeah, and are you aware that the regulations have been amended to come into effect next week?
Or
the stock exclusion, low slope measurement regulations?
No, it wasn't.
Okay. So they've basically got a provision in there which allows a landowner, if the map says they're low slope, they're entitled to demonstrate that it's not low slope and they can effectively prove that they're not, to provide their on-site accuracy. But the default position is that people can look at a national database and say, yes, I need to fix it all. Now, so that's Cooker Teak Tree. Now, if we go down four pages to 0966, so this is the same parcel of land. Members of the court, I mentioned that this was the farm right on the boundary of the Upper White Park, one of the Upper White Park catchments. The jagged sort of tooth marks around the side is the edge of the PC1 catchment. has modelled. And I'm reasonably sure I'm right in this. I've yet to meet a farmer that would do a fence in a staircase pattern. So I'm reasonably sure that the fence line, other than around the edges, are in the accurate locations. So this here, this map shows, doesn't it, the areas of that farm that are within 0 to 5 degrees in purple, 5 to 10 degrees that are in grey, and those that are above and not coloured.
Yep.
Most of the farm is in areas on this map that's greater than 10 degrees, isn't it?
Yep, from that map.
And there's a significant number of streams on that map that, depending on which version of the people's rules you took, would need to be fenced.
For 0 to 10, yeah.
No, sorry, above 10. Above 10 degrees, there's a lot of maps that there'll be a lot of areas that would need to be fenced. So if we went from 10 to 15, so.
Potentially, yeah, that was the route that we might decide to go down or look for alternative options, which would be.
But remember the DairyNZ Fonterra proposal doesn't allow you to put forward alternative proposals. Their proposal is just if you don't meet it, you break Schedule C. So that's their proposal, I'm not saying we agree with it. And then you'll see on that map as well, if you see there in the middle of the page, there's Bush 2, and just underneath that, you'll see that there's a gully system that's already been fenced off. If you look right in the middle, under 4.64, you can see the fence line that's gone around the gully system. It's already been fenced off, probably because it made sense. Can you see that? So we don't know because the national map doesn't have a 10 to 15 degree layer, we don't know how much of the farm is between 10 to 15 degrees. You'll understand from my client's perspective and the desire for certainty and the desire to be able to look at a map and understand reasonably easily what they need to fence, why their strong preference is to rely on any of these low slope map and fence up to 10 degrees. You understand that from a practical perspective.
Yeah.
And even from a council enforcement perspective, it would be a lot easier, wouldn't it?
Having something that somebody, multiple people can look at and come out with the same answer is makes compliance a lot easier. Or helping monitoring or making decisions a lot easier because different people are going to come up with the same, are going to have the same answer.
And that would be a real risk, wouldn't it, if someone had to go and work out whether a slope was between 0 and 15 degrees on a case-by-case, paddock-by-paddock basis, depending on who did it.
It would come down to having a robust process and structure for that method of calculating that has been placed to reduce the risk of different outcomes according to who's done.
But at a high level and in understanding that I think certainly my clients are in violent agreement that both AWA need to be restored and that there needs to be significant work done, you would agree that a requirement to fence up to 10 degrees is more stringent than the stock exclusion regulations?
Yes.
So if I could just ask you to go to the document you had before, which was the rules, which I've now lost, I have here. Schedule C, so I think that's page 40 of the provisions. Yes. I just need to go back over these a little bit. I know my friend touched on them briefly. So we've talked about the 10 and 15 degrees, and that's the difference that's between some parties that obviously we need to get to a landing on. So the next requirement is, if it's over 10 degrees, and the land in Roman 1, if the land's used for intensive grazing, then you have to fence it, even if it's over 10 degrees. Do you agree with me that the definition of intensive grazing includes risky animal or risky farming, or sorry, risky as it relates to water quality farming activities?
I would need to refer back to the definition of what the intensive grazing is in terms of stock exclusion.
It includes break feeding. That's a reasonably risky activity from a water quality perspective.
Yep.
It includes feed grazing on annual forage crops.
Yep.
That would be a risky activity. And grazing on pasture that's been irrigated in the previous 12 months. Do you agree that would probably be the three most risky, from a water quality perspective, grazing practices for dry stock farm?
For grazing practices, yeah. Cropping would be...
So leave arable would be... Yep. Be brave to do arable cropping on some of the land out there. So that's in Roman 1. So you don't get a workaround for Roman 1. So there's no flexibility being sought by my client. That's just that you've got a fence. So what's left in Roman 2 that my client's seeking some flexibility for? Are those activities other than the three we've just mentioned, i.e. it's not intensive grazing, so it's all other grazing. And now we come to the reference to the 18 stock units. My client's position is that the 18 stock units should be removed entirely because it is meaningless. I'm not sure whether you've seen it in the evidence, but I've certainly seen evidence in the references to pure speculation that the panel might have got it wrong, and when they referred to 18 stock units in a paddock, they were meaning across the farm. But leaving that aside, can I ask you to go to, because no one I don't think's yet in the hearings mentioned the definition of stock units, which has echoes of the pig equivalent unit and the Auckland unitary plan. But if we go to the table in the proposed plan, somewhere where I find it, there's a table of stock equivalent. There's a table of stock units.
Page 78, 79.
So page 79, 78, 79. So this is the table of stock units. So when we talk about if there's a limit of 18 stock units per hectare, so that would be three dairy bulls, that would actually breach it because it would be over 18. 18 rams at one stock unit, three beef bulls, so that gets to 18. So that limit in the proposed provision would apply irrespective of how big the paddock is, wouldn't it?
So that those limits are on a per hectare basis.
So if you had a 10 hectare paddock, you could have 30. Is that right?
10 hectare paddock, 180 stock units. Stock type.
I think you mentioned an answer to my friend that it would be very... before I go there. So, if you read Mr. Berry's evidence, and I don't need to take you to it because I'm sure you'd be aware of... You're aware of the difference between set stocking and rotational grazing.
Yes.
So, set stocking is you put a set number of animals in a paddock and you leave them.
Mm-hmm.
Rotational grazing, you move stock around all the paddocks on the farm in response to different weather conditions. If the paddock's particularly wet, you move them out. If the grass is growing more in one paddock, you move them there. And you move them around the farm to where is in accordance with good farming practice. And Mr. Berry in his evidence said that he is concerned that any rotational grazing proposition would breach that 18 stock unit limit. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that.
So what that would encourage is people to do set stocking, which is leave animals in a paddock, effectively, And Mr. Vary's experience is that that can cause far more damage because it doesn't allow the paddocks to recover, there are issues with animal health, etc. Would you agree with that?
Yes, again, it's very farm-specific in terms of what that paddock is, where it is it low-lying, is it wet, you know, to cause those other things. So, but generally, yes.
So we would want to, would you agree with me that the court should be slow to impose limits in a Schedule C minimum standards that would go against good farming practice?
Like the joint witnessing statements that we did, everyone agreed that that number was too low. But what no one can agree on is what that number should be. So I think there's a consensus that where that number came from, we're not too sure. So I would see logically for that to work, that number would need to increase. Just on but where to? Number of joint witnessing conferences now cannot come up with an alternative.
And you know what my client's alternative is, which is to delete it altogether. So, and the reason for that is it is effectively meaningless, which I think all the experts agree, or at least they couldn't come up with another number, and instead rely on the farm certifier to look at the farm system that is being run, to look at the farm, to look at look at all the individual characteristics of an individual farm, and at that point indicate whether or not, in what circumstances, land above 10 degrees should be used.
I agree in that, except for that's indicating that all plans would need to be certified.
No, just this element of that plan might need to be certified. And I'm not sure if you can read... so the proposal, certainly the proposal from my client, is that that element at least is certified. Because my client understands that there is a degree of discretion involved in that aspect, but it's expert judgment. And it's very hard to write a rule, I think we've all agreed today, to cover every situation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Would you feel more comfortable with deleting the stock unit number if there is a requirement for those other mitigations to be certified?
I would be a lot more comfortable because that is the requirement of D2. So
yeah.
If you're going to do it in D2 and that was available in D1 and there was a certification to allow the discussion to take place, to allow the assessment to take place, that could be a logical different pathway here.
And it would also be efficient, wouldn't it? Because it wouldn't require you to get a consent just to require a certifier.
Not in that instance. I need to defer to planners as to how that would work practically. It would obviously be a cost to that from the farmer to have a certifier come out to the farm, to go around the farm and assess those individual paddocks. So that, you know, is an additional cost that if that takes 3 hours with travel, that could be a $600-$700 exercise.
I hasten to ask this, but don't you think it would be a lot cheaper than getting a resource consent?
I'm unaware of what the price of that resource consent would be, but I would suggest it would be no.
Right, thank you. Right, if we can now go to more rebuttal paragraph 34. Oh, actually, sorry, before I do that, just finishing off that last question. So, I think there are some questions about what a certifier might look at, and I think my friend covered most of the issues, but I just want to briefly say. So, in deciding whether or not a fence, a stream on land over 10 degrees would need to be fenced. So this is the certification process. So do you agree that the certifier would look at identification of water sources, including troughs?
Yes.
Water troughs? Identification of areas of shade? Stock classes that will and won't be grazed in that paddock? Ages, types, etc.
Yep.
Grazing management in that paddock in terms of whether it's rotational grazing, duration, what the residual cover is intended to be at the end. Yep, cover that. Times of the year or circumstances when grazing in that paddock wouldn't be appropriate. Certain times of the year after certain rainfall, certain weather conditions. All of those sort of things are measures that would significantly improve water quality despite the stock not being excluded, wouldn't it?
Yeah. The other things I would add to that would be the assessment of the bank in terms of stock access and the likelihood that stock would access and the likelihood of the damage as they went down there, if they did have access, if they went down there. I think that's a consideration that you would build into that as well.
Yeah. Thank you. That was sorry. We're back to 34. So at paragraph 34, so this is talking favourite topic, setbacks. So you say there the stock exclusion regulations include a 3 metre setback rule, which is an actual setback rather than an average setback. And then on this basis, I do not consider an actual setback for 3 metres to be an unreasonable expectation. Do you agree with me that the PC1 requirements are significantly more onerous than the stock exclusion regulations?
Yes.
Because the stock exclusion regs only apply to permanent intermittent streams of greater than width greater than a metre.
Yeah.
Yeah. PC1 applies to permanent intermittent streams of any size.
Yeah.
So there's likely to be a lot more areas of quite tight streams in gullies, and I'm thinking here of gullies, and if you've been to some of that hill country farm, you can see some of the streams in the gully systems. Very difficult to provide 3 metre setback minimum on all sides of all streams at all times, wouldn't it? From a practical on-farm perspective.
If you were going to stick to the 3, there may be occasions where you go beyond the 3 because the 3 is a minimum. So you may decide, well, I can't stick to the 3 because of other reasons, and in my assessment, the farmer in his assessment could say, well, actually, there's a risk on the slope there, so I'm going to take that back further because I want to do some riparian planting. So they're the kind of decisions or considerations he would also need to make at the same time, rather than just saying it's 3 metres.
Yeah, and I guess the proposition from my clients is that rather than be a minimum of 3 metres, it's a minimum of 1 metre, at least on certain streams, and an average of 3.
Yeah.
So you agree that would give more flexibility?
Would give more flexibility. My concerns would be on a lot of streams, 1 is not enough, because as people have said today, when stock walk along the banks, even though they're inside the paddock, they can still push the bank in. My other consideration would be, if we're accepting that we can go to 1 metre there, the farmer needs to accept that he's got to go to 5 somewhere else to counteract that to get an average of 3, and that may be in a paddock where he's actually got really good land and he didn't want to lose those additional 2 metres.
But there could be 2 things. One, that could be the subject of a discussion with the certifier too, couldn't it?
Could be.
Certifier was on land, as we'll deal with that issue too. Yeah.
Could be.
And that would allow, again, some of that expert judgment together with the on-farm knowledge of the farmer to decide, okay, well, in these circumstances, what's the most practical site here?
Could be.
And you'd agree with Dr. Scarsbrook's comment, there would seem to be lunacy to be cutting benches into the sides of banks in order to put a 3 metre setback in when you could put a 1 metre setback in with no earthworks.
again, that is very site-specific, because if there's a bank in, the reason for a bank in, that means you've got a bank you've got to take out. So the question I would always ask in the discussion with the farmer is, what's the risk of this here? Should I actually be going further out and looking at other options? And that's one of the beauties of the farm environment plan. It allows that discussion to allow for a farmer to look for additional benefits both for the environment and for his own business, in one, making it easy for him to do the fencing, make it safer for him to get his stock out, easy to get stock out of paddock, quicker to tie land. So, but I can't answer that question without seeing a slight specific. Yeah.
And my client's concern with clause 2, the minimum standards, is there is no flexibility as worded currently. That you would support some degree of flexibility with a certifying.
There's no flexibility to go below 3, but there's flexibility to go above 3.
Yeah, but if you needed flexibility to go below 3 and it was certified as being appropriate in that case, and there were circumstances, for example, if it was on the downhill slope, then that there would be no water risk for that, would there?
My experience is going down to 1. I think in a lot of situations that causes increased risk, because normally where you measure the bank started from, your 1 metre will be covered in the side of the bank and not the top of the bank. So that means the farmer with 1 metre will be able to fence right on top of the bank, which then creates different issues in terms of contamination, potential contamination. That's why I always get very nervous when people talk about 1 metre, because 1 metre is normally that bit of a bank, not that bit.
Yeah, but that's something that a certifier could look at. A farmer could go out and say, this is the alignment I'm considering.
Yes.
What do you think? The certifier's got to certify the ultimate alignment. That's something they could address.
So if it was being certified, that could be, you know, I could see that as a logical discussion, but if the plan was not being certified,
yeah,
and I'm thinking where Schedule C could be used for people like low-intensity farmers where they don't need a farm environment plan, you need to provide them with really good guidance.
Yep, I understand that, but it's a drafting issue, right? So you could word Schedule C, so you either meet that, or if you want the flexibility, you could get certified. Yep?
Yeah.
Another question I've got is the time frame for doing all of this fencing. So, is your evidence that the fencing, I think your, this comes into your rebuttal evidence of paragraphs 36 and 37. So, my clients are concerned that there's simply not the time, probably nor the money, but certainly not the time to be able to do all the fencing. At your paragraph 36, you'll say this will mean it is unlikely that all requirements could be completed for all farms within the 2-year period.
Yeah.
So we don't want to set this up to fail. So what do you have any idea what a reasonable time frame is?
If I was to prioritise fencing, like once a farmer has done an assessment like anything else, he prioritises and then he works out his plan, and then you would prioritise, and logical would say you'd prioritise according to what the national environment standards for stock exclusion were, which would have been 0 to 5, and then you would prioritise the rest, because they've got some timeframes that we can't move. But I do agree that depending on the amount that we believe there's to do, that the timeframes to complete all the fencing is unachievable in 2, and coming back to the comments of, we don't want to create this mountain so high that the farmer just totally turns away, so let's take this in small chunks and give the farmer a timeline and a process that's workable. I do agree.
So because before you fence it, you've got to get water troughs, you've got to get water reticulation, you've got to get power,
yeah,
you've got to do all of that before you even start fence.
Yeah.
So my client's proposition is that the farmers effectively as a permitted activity have 5 years from the date PC1 becomes operative to complete their fencing.
Yeah.
Or if they want to apply for consent, they get controlled activity consent, they get 10 years, but there's 10 years from the date PC1 becomes operative. So you can't wait 4.5 years and then say, oh, now I want another 10. And the intention is that there would be reporting on the fencing that would be done in the farm plans, that would set out a proposal, what do you need to do, stage it, so all of that would be demonstrated in the farm plan. Do you think that's a practical, realistic solution?
The logic of 5 years,
yes.
In terms of the consent, we've got the great ability because the assessment's been made, we know exactly what's to be done. So if that farmer, once the assessment's been made, has got 2 kilometres to give him 10 years, is probably there's no need. So it's about saying, well, the duration to do that could be relevant to the amount of work to be done, which is fair and reasonable for everybody.
Yeah. And sorry, when I say 10 years, the proposition, my clients are not here to put this on the never-never. We understand the importance of doing it in the right place. And the proposition is that it's a maximum of 10 years. You can't apply for consent for...
Yep.
The intention was to stop people saying it's going to take me 25 years to do it because I'm putting in one post a year. Because there is a limit to the number of fencing contractors who could do this work, right? And it's a serious question. Like, there's going to be a lot of fencing required. A lot of materials needed. It's going to be a struggle, isn't it?
Yeah. The reason why I tripled is my brother-in-law is fencing.
I was going to say, you don't know a fencing company, do you?
And we never see it. He just sees work ahead of himself, and not just the availability of the contracts, it's the availability of the materials as a concern to them as fencing contractors.
Yeah. And I think we've dealt with this before, but with the last witness. Sheep are obviously, and you'll be more familiar with them, sheep tend to be fully insulated and see they have less of a problem with electric fences and can push them over, etc. They need more substantial, more expensive fencing.
Yeah.
So especially the dry stock farms in the high country that has a mixture, they're likely to need, they're not going to get away in a lot of circumstances with just a single wire or two wires.
No, generally a hill country would be looking for a 5-wire fence because they're going to put it in and put it in once. 30 years.
So another NPSFM comes in. So just the last thing is the time frames for existing races and culverts. So this is in Schedule D1, Clause 6B. And this is covered in your rebuttal evidence at paragraphs 58 and 59. And so just so everyone's clear, because it got me very confused, so races, let me find it.
Sure.
So you got that?
Yep,
top of 58. So races, the reference to races are the laneways on farms that animals move to from paddocks on. And they're generally very heavily trafficked. Certainly with dairy farms?
It all depends on the farm.
Yeah. There's a requirement that the new existing races, laneways, culverts, crossings and bridges meet the standards within 3 years of PC1 becoming operative.
Yeah.
So given that might involve... in terms of doing that, runoff, etc., from the laneways, etc., from the races rather, needs to get diverted away from streams, etc., that could require quite substantial work.
It can, but in my experience, diversion of water off races is a daily activity that's already in place for most farmers. Thinking of the dairy farms that tend to have more permanent races. Dry stock farmers tend to have less of the permanent races and use either a grassed race or they use the paddock as their races. So in the dairy farm situation, that tends to be normal practice. So I would not see that a lot of braces would need to be moved as a result of that. But we do know there's a history of some dairy farms with braces next to waterways, which is challenging for some people.
Yeah, and so the races next to the drains in particular, for example, that you might be thinking of, even on flat land, that might require a complete rejigging of their paddock layout, their race layout.
Yep. It may do if other potential mitigations are assessed or exhausted and are not meeting the requirements. So that I'm thinking of contouring the race, diving the race away from the from the receiving environment, using either small buffers or cutouts at strategic places. At the bottom of the race, you can dig a bund or a hole, which then collects the water and takes all the sediment out. So there are options available. It's around assessing which options are appropriate for that farming instance, and that's where I see the real value of the farm environment plan, is to have that discussion with a certified advisor to work through that process.
Yeah.
You have much more.
I do have one more topic, so I'm having to stop if that's easy. I was about to say that, and I lost the side.
Well, I think we probably should wrap up and not go beyond time.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Because you may well be a little wild about that, and that everybody will start to get.
I hate to be responsible for that.
Indeed. So we'll pause here. I'm not sure if you were present when I was addressing other witnesses during the breaks. So you're under cross-examination. Just not talk to anyone about the case or your evidence, and we'll see you back here ready for 9:30 tomorrow. Is that convenient?
That's okay.
9:30 tomorrow, everyone. At some stage, Mr. Conway and other counsel will just have a chat about the sort of progress we're making. I have a feeling that we're probably running a little bit slower than I have anticipated, and I don't know what knock-on effect there may be, but you may just want to check that with your colleagues and consider whether there's, I mean, we certainly have space in the calendar base for it, but as Ms. Tumai has raised earlier, other people are making plans about when their witnesses arrive, and we just want to be reasonably efficient and effective about that. Any other housekeeping matters that anyone wants to raise? Yes.
Yes, Your Honour, I'm Ms. Hooper, Junior Counsel for assisting Ms. Tumai.
Thank you,
Ms. Hooper. Just seeking leave for tomorrow, I've got another mediation. Ms. Tumai has given me permission.
No, well, of course, there's leave to come and go generally, and that applies to everyone on the team. Thank you for letting me know. Anything else? Very good. All right, we'll just see you back here at 9:30 tomorrow.
Did you see it?